Well, the media are full of stories about traumatic events, from school shootings to natural disasters. And today we're talking about how you can help your children or your grandchildren deal with those kinds of problems. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Pleased to have back Heather Shoemaker. She is the author of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide and It's Okay Not to Share. In those books, she talks about how to raise competent and compassionate kids by turning everything you thought you knew about raising kids a bit upside down. So, what problems have you encountered when talking to your kids about scary events? Questions you might have for Heather about child rearing. I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Heather Shoemaker, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be back. Thanks so much.
You've written two books about parenting. Maybe first just talk about your philosophy about bringing up children.
Well, it is a little different than many. As you say, it turns up most of the ideas that we think we know about children and how to raise children upside down and on its head. So the title of the one, It's Okay Not to Share, that right there really gets people's attention because it's something we try to force on kids almost as soon as they can walk. But the books are not against sharing and generosity and goodness. They just are taking a different way to get to the same goal.
Yeah. I bought several copies of your book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, and pass them on to teachers in our local grade school. And I found a lot to be thinking about in that book.
Yes, and it's okay to go up the slide. I mean, the whole title is about thinking about doing things differently and questioning why we do things a certain way, especially when it comes to education, kindergarten, homework, recess, lots of those ideas. So sharing with teachers is a great way to get the conversation started.
There's been some pretty horrific things happening in the news these days, as you well know. How do we help kids understand what's going on?
Yeah, I think that we often don't do anything with young kids about the news because we're unsure. We don't know what to do. We don't know if we should protect them and not talk about it. We don't know because we don't have all the answers. Maybe we shouldn't even bring it up. So there's a lot of uncertainty on the adults' part. And, of course, we all wish these bad news stories would just go away.
Yeah.
For their own merits. And but when they don't, I mean, some of it's human-caused and some of it's natural disasters, but we're guaranteed that some bad things are going to be happening every year and throughout our lives. So we need to find a way to talk about it with our families and with our children growing up. A basic idea is that, one, the kids know more than we think. Even
yeah.
If you're in a household that doesn't replay the TV news over and over, or doesn't even have a TV, they pick things up from peers. They pick up our anxiousness or our fears and confusion. They know something big is going on. So if there's been a major event in the news, chances are your child knows something and might be feeling worried about it. But they often get misinformation, maybe misinformation from peers. So it's okay to open up the conversation and just say, what have you been hearing? What do you know about this? And see where that gets you.
That's probably a good idea. I'm sure that there are some children who may be even afraid to go to school from time to time.
Yes, and you know, a lot of the focus in the news has been on high school level students, but of course they have younger siblings and all kids, if they hear the word school, even if they're in preschool and they're 3 and 4 years old, they know that school is a place where kids are, and a school is likely a big, big part of their lives. So when there's big things in the news about a school shooting, kids pick that up, and they do have questions. A good rule of thumb is if a child is old enough to ask, she's old enough to get an honest answer. So even if she's 3 years old or 10 years old or whatever age, and you're thinking, oh gosh, I'm not ready to talk about this right now, if the child's old enough to ask a question, she deserves an honest answer from the adults around her.
Yeah. So if the child says, I don't want to go to school because I'm afraid I'm going to get shot, what do you say?
Well, that's the kind of thing where you have to just take a deep breath and say, you have to also say things such as, you know, school is a safe place. If I didn't think it was safe, I wouldn't send you there, knowing in the back of your mind that, of course, it's not completely safe. But you can also tell the child, you know, you can, if you go outside, you could get hit by lightning. It, chances are you won't. Some people do. It's very, very unlikely this is going to happen to you. But don't rule it out that they're going to be completely safe. So don't offer a completely false assurance, but you can say things such as, I will do everything I can to keep you safe. The teachers will do everything they can to keep you safe. So getting this sense of safety, and I think it's important to remember that although we cannot guarantee absolute physical safety for our kids, we can give them emotional safety. And kids will feel safe if their feelings are listened to and understood. Now, this is more for the younger kids. If there's high school age kids and older listening, they're going to say, yeah, right, that my feelings aren't enough. But they're the ones that are able to take more of a political action as well, as the younger kids need to know the adults around them will do everything they can to keep them safe. And if you as a parent are honestly worried that wherever you are sending your child is not safe, then you need to change where you're sending them.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned lightning, and that reminded me that we're approaching the tornado season in Wisconsin. Tornadoes, there's been a lot in the news about fire. So natural disasters come into play as well. Today, they're in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. They're burning down a building that was the result in an explosion, and the materials that were embedded into the building itself are so bad that they're actually burning it down. So there's a lot of news like that on the air. Do you take sort of the same approach, or what do you do?
Well, natural disasters are a little easier because the moral complications aren't there. It's easier to say, this is part of how the world works, and there are huge storms and tornadoes happen, and we live in a place, depending where your child lives, either that we can get tornadoes from time to time. With any kind of disaster like that, whether it's fire or a hurricane or a tornado, kids need to know what to do in case of an emergency. So like teaching a child to stop, drop, and roll with fire, you teach them, you know, go to the basement or, you know, what you do wherever you are at school and at home with a tornado, and talk about that. And if something has just happened, let's say a tornado does come through a community and hurts people, it's okay to talk about how sad that is. I think we often are afraid to talk about it because we don't want to get to those scary feelings, those feelings of sorrow and feelings of fear. But talking about them makes it better. And it's okay that we can't fix it. It's okay that we don't have all the answers. We can just say, I feel sad too, and share that with the child.
Talking today with Heather Shoemaker, writer and speaker on early childhood topics. She's an advocate for free, unstructured play in homes and schools, and she's the author of It's Okay Not to Share and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide: Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Questions for her maybe about this whole business about dealing with the things that are happening in the news and how to talk to them. Maybe you've had some experiences on that. Or other questions relating to raising children, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. You know, going back to the Renegade Rules, I wondered as I was thinking about this and talking a bit with Jill, if your thoughts on these rules have changed as your own children have grown.
You know, it's funny. I wrote these books. I started writing them before I even had children. I was pregnant with my first child. And so many of these philosophies, they were informed by the preschool that I went to school as a child myself, were informed, you know, before I had kids. And I must say that although I like to think I'm open-minded, as I raised my own children, I found the truth of these philosophies just strengthened. Instead of, contradicted. So it's been something that I didn't write these books based on my own kids, but interacting with children, my own and others, I find that these are universal truths that help people of all ages, because it's mostly about conflict management and dealing with difficult emotions, and that's something all of us need, and the earlier we can start with it, the easier it becomes throughout life.
Yeah, for sure. Diana in Madison, it's your turn to join in. Thank you for calling. Diana, are you there?
I just wanted to comment that I thought that the speaker was spot on as far as what the how that children react to either disasters or incidences that have happened that are really detrimental, and that that kids take their cues from how parents are, or teachers or significant adults are responding, reacting. And I was a teacher, and I know that when we stayed calm, when something happened, the children, you know, their eyes are on you, and, you know, they tend to stay much more calm when you're calm. And so I think that that is very important, as well as, you know, the response of answering questions honestly. And I see this too with high schoolers and even going into adulthood, that when we have a grounded place of security and safety, that we can face things, make difficult decisions. And as a teacher, I saw that. I did teach K-12. And so I think that that was really important, what she said about answering honestly, depending on the grade level. But I think, too, combined with that was the way that we as adults present ourselves to the kids while these things are happening. And thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. A comment, Heather?
Well, yeah, I think what she's saying is we don't need to have all the answers, but we need to be there for the kids. We need to be caring adults, and we can't change what happened. Maybe we can take steps to make things not happen quite the same way in the future, but we can't change the past, but we can change how we respond. And I think one thing besides sorting out the feelings and answering questions honestly is to model for the children what it looks like to be a caring person and take some compassionate action. And kids are really good at doing that. It's just the same on a higher level as when a child bumps into another kid with her tricycle or some level like that, and you want them to say sorry, when it's better if they can take some action that shows kindness, go get an ice pack, go get a Band-Aid, and promise you're not going to do it again, that's stronger than just looking on and saying sorry. So on these bigger news disasters, you know, what can you do and involve your child? Can you, can you send something to the disaster area, for example? Can you take some action together?
Very good points. Diana, thank you again for calling. Heather Shoemaker, our guest today, as we talk about raising children, how to talk to them about what's in the news and other child development issues. Our guest, Heather Shoemaker. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Heather Shoemaker, author of It's Okay Not to Share and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Join in with your own thoughts, experiences to share, or questions as we visit with her. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. In terms of the renegade rules that you talk about, and you've been talking about them for a number of years now. What's the general reaction that you get from parents?
Well, depending on the rule, let's say one about it's okay to let kids hit and kick, and they all say, oh, no. But when you explain it and you say, not hit and kick you, not hit and kick another person or an animal, but if they're very angry, to get some of that emotional energy out by hitting a pillow, and then getting into the research in the background, there's a lot of ahs and understanding, because even though it seems opposite, the underpinnings of it are all based on child development and trust and respect on both sides.
What about let your kids swear?
Yeah, that's always a fun one.
I wondered how they would react to that one.
Well, again, you have to look at what swearing is, which is for a young child, ooh, exciting, powerful words. And if I say it, what kind of reaction will I get from my parents? They pick up on the power of those words right away, even before they can talk. Their radar goes up, and they say, ooh, that was exciting. Wonder if I can pull that one out. So the let your kids swear is about, you know, you cannot control how they sleep. You can't push the sleep button, and you can't push the stop talking button. It doesn't work. So banning things, like not being able to say certain words, really can backfire big time. But it's perfectly fine to set limits on what you want to hear and to let kids know that some words are inappropriate, especially at certain times and places. So let your kids swear means you can say that word as much as you want in the bathroom with the door closed. And they do. Sometimes a kid will go off, leave the table, say, excuse me, leave the table, go to the bathroom, shut the door, and yell a little bit.
Well, and they have to learn those words from somebody, and it's often, I imagine, the parents anyway.
It's often the parents, you know, here and there things come out. Or if they don't hear it from the parents, if you're a very mild-spoken household, then as soon as they hit school, they'll learn them all the first week.
Irv in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Irv. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I was single for about 23 years before I met Teresa, and I was 50 years old when Jeff was born. Before that, I had experience with other people's children. And here's what I learned. Your relationship with the child starts when they're crawling on the floor. Mm-hmm. Don't expect anything when they're age 14 to start a relationship with them. Two, what you accept, you teach. And the last one is you teach by example. Make no bones about it. And that's what I wanted to offer in addition to the information that the young lady has in the book. It sounds very good.
Irv, thank you so much. What do you think about Irv's thoughts on this, Heather?
He's a natural. No, I think the relationship comment is something that I think we all recognize on some level, but we're in this for the long haul. And some of the approaches that the renegade parenting uses may seem messy and take a little time, take up more time than you think you have at that moment to cope with. But over the long term, it makes life and the relationship much easier. So if you have a child who's very upset, you know, won't put their shoes on, some little thing, depending, and you think it's not worth getting into a problem over it, but how you react then may take a little more time. It may take a little bit more mess and tears to figure something out when they're young. But if you continue to be confident in how you're accepting their emotions and respecting them, it will get easier and easier as they go. And the point about modeling can't be said enough.
Yeah. Although I have to tell you, having a 14-year-old daughter, it is surprising how their minds change when they hit those teen years.
Yes, well, teens' brains are supposed to change.
Yeah.
But they also they have a come to me, treat me as a child, and push away, treat me as an adult, going on both at the same time, sometimes within the same minute, and that's okay. But under it all, they're a human being with emotions, and we just need to connect with those emotions, go to the feelings, and most of the conflicts that we have to do with unrecognized feelings, misunderstood feelings, or not giving each other a full attention.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Sue in Boston, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question. My daughter is special needs. She's 30 years old, so we've been kind of gone through these issues for many, many years. But what she hears quite often, unfortunately, or sees in the newspaper, are crimes of a sexual nature. And sometimes I'm not quite sure how the wording should be. You know, she has quite high anxiety anyway. But so I thought maybe you'd have some tips on maybe some wording that I haven't used.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, her level of special needs, but if she can understand what the news story is about and she's anxious it might happen to her, is that what her the main concern is?
I don't know that it's so much that. She's at about a third or fourth grade level, and she knows it's wrong, and she just hears it, you know, and all this stuff was about this gymnast and all that kind of stuff. It was all over the news and all over everywhere. You know, and she'll just bring it up. I don't know that she's necessarily worried that it's going to happen to her, but, you know, I tell her, you know, these people, they'll tell you not to say anything, and the first thing you need to always do, and we've talked about it so many, many times, you know, you always come to me, you always talk to somebody, but I just thought maybe you'd have a tip.
Well, there's so many, with a topic like this, there's so many levels. So one of them is if it's something in the news that keeps popping up in the news and so it keeps coming to her attention, which it certainly does these days, is to ask her, what do you want to know about it, or what worries you about that? Ask a few questions, see where she's coming from, and then try to answer whatever question she has at the level that's right for her. And then sometimes knowing when to stop, and this could be the case with your daughter or a child of a different age, is sometimes we can go on and on and on explaining a disaster or a problem like this, and the kids are actually done and they're ready to move on. So you can say, have I answered your question? Do you have enough right now? And see if they're ready to leave the topic, because sometimes it can get too much. And it sounds as if you've already done some of the, you know, excellent groundwork of personal safety, which, you know, if it feels bad, it is bad. Tell somebody. If it's, you know, if there's your stomach has that uh-oh feeling, then it's wrong and you need to speak up. Those kinds of messages need to come throughout our lives to remind ourselves of listen to that gut instinct and ask for help, especially if someone's telling you to keep a bad secret.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Sue, for calling. Appreciate it. Take some more calls. By the way, you can join in, too. An open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your question or maybe your experience to share in this area. Beth in Montfort, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just had a comment about initially you had said something about if the child is old enough to ask, then they're old enough to get an honest answer. And I kind of, let me throw this at you. So I've got a bunch of kids, and my youngest is 5. And he's coming home with stories about the Easter Bunny, about Santa, and right now he wants to set up a leprechaun trap so we can get their gold. So when it comes to issues like that, and he goes to school, I don't want to be the mom who's like, oh, yeah, that's baloney, you know.
Yeah.
As well, yeah. So what we've tried to do with our kids is, kind of not give an honest answer, kind of dodge it, but talk about our values. Like the reason we are not setting up a leprechaun trap is in our family, we don't just take stuff from other people because they're little and we can't. We don't exploit that. So if there's a leprechaun who's got his gold, you know, if you want gold, get a job. You know, make your money and get it yourself. But I don't tell them the whole truth on that. But then I guess, on the other hand, like listening to Sue, and her daughter with anxiety. My first kid did have anxiety and would worry about, like, school shootings. So I was very truthful. I said, you know, kiddo, here's what's most likely to kill you. Suicide, not wearing your belt, drugs, opium. You know, if you stop smoking and stop taking opium, and then he laughs because he doesn't do it, then you're so much safer. And so trying to put it in perspective for the older kids, but also preserving the joy of Santa and the Easter Bunny and such for the younger kids and making that balance, I think, is really important. Well, so I wondered what you think about that.
Oh, some great comments.
Great comment. Well, at first
we won't even go into when they ask where the baby came from and how he got in there.
My books do get into all that. I love talking about it.
You can come over.
Yeah, those are for sex ed and all those talks about death and all those difficult things like, Mommy, are you going to die? Are you going to die tonight? And all those sorts of things that they want to ask you right when you're putting them to bed. Those are the kinds of topics and news disasters that I would put in that if she's old enough to ask, old enough to get an honest answer. I didn't expect we'd be talking about the Easter Bunny today and leprechauns, but I always love talking about them. it is a different category. It's a category that many families love to perpetuate childhood joy, and that sounds like that's where your family is. You can put that in a different category. You don't have to, string it out. I think at a certain age, if they're 10 or 12 and they're coming to you and want the straight answer, they're of an age to get the straight answer. If they're 3 and 4 and 5 and younger, elementary, and they're having fun with it and you're having fun with it, then go ahead and keep that joy going. So, yeah, there's some exceptions to the truth rule.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, thank you. Because, yeah, too much truth is going to get you calls from angry parents.
But the leprechaun trap is interesting. I wouldn't personally, the way I would do it is say, well, how are you going to build your trap and let them incorporate it in their own play? I wouldn't, get too moralizing about stealing the gold, but see how they, and that's because of my whole philosophy towards play, and it comes into the news disasters too, which is children play to make sense of their world, and whatever's coming into their world, whether it's leprechauns or news stories, they will incorporate it into their thoughts, and their thoughts come out in their play, so whatever they need to play. And sometimes play can get quite disturbing. I mean, after 9/11, there was a lot of kids playing plane crashes and buildings falling over. And every time there's a news disaster, that kind of play shows up. So don't worry about that kind of play. Often play looks so harmless and fun, we don't worry about it. But sometimes we do get worried when we see certain themes coming out or certain adult news things coming out in their play. But that's very healthy for them to be playing it out.
Well, thank you for your perspective on that, because I wasn't quite sure how much truth is too much and at what point you cut them off and say, nope, we don't do that.
Beth, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about Halloween. And what I did when Emily was a child, or what we did, was she'd go out and she'd come back with, 80 pieces of candy, and I would tell her that she could pick 10 pieces, and then she would leave the rest, and the great pumpkin would come and take them and give them to other children.
And I hope that meant that you and your wife ate it when she was at school.
Well, it took it to work, actually. It disappears always at work. But then the great pumpkin would always leave a little gift, thank you gift. So we always had a little thank you gift from the great pumpkin. So, Heather, I was lying through my teeth on that one, but was that okay?
You know what? I kind of think having a bunch of kids and seeing them grow up, that if it works for you, it works. And don't judge anyone else, because if it works for somebody else, then that's great. But that's just our take on it. So,
yeah, there's more than one right way to raise a child. There's many right ways.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your perspective on things.
Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that great pumpkin thing worked really well, and I sometimes give it to my students at the UW as well when at the start of a class. Ben in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi there. I'm very interested in this conversation today, so thank you for having it.
Sure.
I was curious what your thoughts are with the role of technology in parenting.
Yes, that is huge today. In my second book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, I have a whole section on technology. And, parents usually start off asking, what can we do about kids and technology? And my answer is sort of split, because one whole chapter I have is about what we can do about parents and technology. Getting back to our earlier caller's point about modeling, because so much of what we need to do about technology for our kids is modeling healthy behavior with it ourselves. They learn so much by watching us glaze over and overindulge or overwork with our technology devices.
So I've actually recently been talking with someone who has some children and said that sometimes that technology could end up being more like a tether, and you're just hyper interested in all times what your child is even doing at every moment of every day. And he said if you could do your best to distance yourself from that, it's exactly like you're saying, like model that behavior that you want, hopefully that it'll pick up on.
Exactly. And I think that this is, it's hard to get away from it once you start falling into the tethering trap. but independence, giving children independence is a huge part of parenting. And it becomes more and more important the older they get. And that has a lot to do with trust. So I don't want to know what my children are doing at every minute. I don't want an update on what they're doing, and I don't expect that they need to be tied to me completely. So it can be a crutch for both sides, and I think that we need to develop kids who are resilient and can cope when their parents are away and can trust that they can cope with the level, you know, let's say you have a elementary age kid, that they can cope if they miss the school bus. What would they do? What can they figure out on their own? That they don't necessarily need to have a cell phone in their pocket in order to call you at every moment. There's a lot of resiliency lessons that we lose when we rely on a few buttons on a phone.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your perspective on that, because I was just expecting a new child soon, and so just anticipating things and trying to figure out with myself and my wife how we're going to approach that, because it is it's everything is so available now at all times. It's unbelievable where we are today, let alone where we'll be in 5 or 10 years. So it's interesting to figure out how we'll incorporate it and what we will do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course the technology will change, you know, even by the time your child is born. But one of the things that we need to watch out for when the children are very little, let's say just babies and toddlers, they are watching what we do and taking that as normal. So I like to show a picture when I give talks of adults with their heads down, you know, in that phone position. You've seen it, where we all get to see at the top of everybody's heads, and nobody knows what you're doing. You might be playing a crossword puzzle. You might be doing work. You might be who knows what. The kids have no idea. They just know that you are absent from them, you are lost to them, and they are not important. So toddlers do steal their parents' cell phones, and I've heard of them being flushed down toilets and various things from jealous jealous toddlers. But be very aware that, even when they're young, that you're modeling what's normal. And if you would like them to pay attention to you and to give full attention when you're there, you know, look around and see how people do it, because many of us aren't aware that we're modeling unhealthy behavior. If you look at school pickup time, many parents have the phone glued to their eyes or their ears when they're picking up their children, for example. And that's a time reconnection when we should put the phone away. And maybe once a year an emergency call comes in and you need to take it, the child will recognize, this is one isn't what normally happens. I will wait, you know, because my dad is usually there for me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. I find I have to drive my daughter to the bus for a pickup for her to go on to high school. And I find those minutes in the morning when we're sitting waiting for the bus, I always make it a point to leave earlier than we need to, so that we have some time alone in the car, just watching, just looking and talking about any number of things.
Right, your connection time. Yeah, that can be, finding those times of day are just critical for parents and children.
Well, that's one time when we're, you know, when we're both there, we're both sitting, and it's a great few minutes for me every morning. I think it is for her too. Georgia emailed to ask how she can get her daughter to go to sleep when she's needs to or is supposed to. She's 13.
Well, 13 is they're a little too big to sit on, but. No, sleep habits are so important, and obviously your listener knows that. And kids need so much more sleep than our modern lifestyle usually allows them. I direct parents to the National Sleep Foundation, which is has lots of research about how much sleep kids at different ages and adults need and how sleep-deprived we are. So how to do that with a 13-year-old, one is, picking up on the technology, is to make sure that there's no TV in the room and that there's no devices in the room when she goes to bed. Another thing is to stop having any screens on at least 30 minutes before she goes to bed, because that just stimulates our brains and tries to keep us awake longer. So to have a calming time before going to bed, which means turning off electronics, keeping them out of the bedroom. And I don't think 13 is too old to be read a bedtime story to, or to come in and have a chat and go to bed that way. But to get some sort of, maybe the child's, you know, 13 could read to herself. In my family, we read aloud to kids until they graduate from high school and leave. My parents both read to me aloud. So that's a loving thing to do if you have the inclination to do that. But whatever it is, to have some sort of calming routine. And to have lights out early, they will actually sleep more if you put them to bed earlier. So, 9:30 is not unreasonable for a 13-year-old. And lights are off, no distractions, and even if she doesn't fall asleep right away, she's resting and she's with her own thoughts and she's not bothering you.
Heather Shoemaker, our guest today. She is the author of It's Okay Not to Share, and also It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. I hope you'll join in with your own experiences, questions, comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. How do you talk to your kids about current events? What questions do you have about talking to kids about all kinds of things, including bad news? What concerns do you have about raising young children? Larry Mueller here with my guest, Heather Shoemaker, author of It's Okay Not to Share and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Glenn emailed us, Heather, to ask about meals with children. How do you get them together when they're so busy?
Well, hopefully he's has children who are older than toddlers when he mentions that they're, how do you get them all together? But kids are very scheduled these days, but they tend not to schedule themselves for the first decade. So we need to look at ourselves and how much are we signing the kids up for things. There's only so much of time that they are awake. They need a lot of sleep. Most of them go to school during the day, so what time is left is quite precious for a variety of things, including downtime and following their own ideas through play or through other... when the kids get a little older, they don't call it play, but it's their form of play, is to express themselves through their free time. So how much are we scheduling them up? Take a look at that and see if you can go down, cut the number in half of things that they're doing. Or finding a certain night of the week that is just going to be the family night. In our family, we try to do that 7 nights, and activities either have to finish before supper or don't happen. But you have to decide what's important to you, and I think his bringing up the point shows that he understands that it is important to come together as a family, and the family meal is one of the age-old traditions for that.
And as we talk about bringing families together, sometimes families are apart. And I'm wondering what you think about children. Divorce is pretty common. I think about half the children, I think it was 40% of the children are in divorced family situations, at least. It's pretty common, even in kids' lives these days. How should parents talk to their children about divorce?
Well, that's huge. Much of it, again, is the same as any difficult topic, which is about emotions and answering questions. So there's going to be all kinds of emotions if you're talking about a divorce that's just happening. And, of course, that's when the parents are exactly not in their best state of mind or heart to be able to cope with any of this. So depending if you think that you can use some help, find another trusted adult. It could be someone in the family or a friend who can help answer some questions for your child when you don't feel emotionally up for it yourself. But be there for your child also. But if it's fine to bring somebody else in to be slightly more calm than you are able to be to help that child.
Just reading something online about a family that, and I guess this is more common nowadays, there's a home, the children have a home, and the parents come to the home. So the parents take turns, and the children don't go from one home to the other.
Wow. Yeah.
You have to have the money to be able to afford that, for sure.
Yeah, that probably involves three homes, doesn't it, instead of two?
My eyebrows went up when I saw that. The other email before Peter, we'll get to you in just a second, but there's another email from Mia that I wanted to bring up too. What is the best way to teach children to be grateful for gifts, and are thank you notes still important?
Maybe she didn't know, but she's talking to a queen of thank you notes. So. I think that addressing thank you notes specifically is something that is not done as much because of technology. People will dash off an email even as an adult. But kids often need something very tangible, and the younger the better, is taking a piece of paper that they can touch and feel. And even we write thank you notes in our family even when the child is too young to read and write, do dictated thank you notes, and the child can make a mark or add a sticker or something onto the piece of paper to make it their own. But this is thank you notes, besides being polite and learning the social graces of society, they help teach literacy, which is the child learns, says something out loud, you take down their dictation and read back to them exactly what they said. And this is powerful. They learn that their words matter and that they can have their same words captured by you writing it down. So even when they're 2 years old, it's never too early for thank you notes. Grateful. Was the question how to teach, help your child learn to be grateful for gifts?
Yes.
Well, I think the cultivating gratefulness is a topic that's big on its own. Specifically for gifts is interesting because our culture does focus on objects and stuff and possessions a lot. So gift giving is a big part of our culture. But I think it's important to teach our children to be grateful in general, not just for objects. So thank you notes, for example, can be for time spent with you, not just a gift or grateful for something else. I don't think we need to teach gratefulness, just as we don't need to teach generosity or compassion or remorse. These things are from inside the human spirit, but we can encourage that and we can guide kids. So the act of doing a thank you note helps them learn a tool for showing their gratefulness. They may not be in a grateful mood at that moment, but it's some action they can take. I think it's important to realize we can't force somebody to feel some way, but we can demonstrate socially acceptable ways of coping with that emotion.
Oh. Peter in Madison, thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi, so what's on your mind?
I've recently come into custody of my 11-year-old nephew. His mother has issues, and at this point in time, he's living with me. And he plays video games. If he's allowed, he will play them from the time he gets up until the time he goes to bed. And I obviously, that's not an okay thing for him to be doing. I guess my question is, how do I wean him, or do I just cut him off cold turkey? I'm not exactly sure how to go about. I want to respect his personhood and make sure that he feels he hasn't had a lot of choice in his life up until this point. So I'm trying to be sensitive to his needs, but I'm well aware that it's not healthy for him to be playing this much video games.
Okay, good question.
Wow, that's tough because and you may not know how long you have him to raise yourself. It may be a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty.
Exactly.
One thing is to give him what he needs to fill up some of his time with things he needs, such as taking him outside and shooting baskets or taking him out for a walk or doing something together that you both enjoy, getting him physically moving. Physical motion is so important for emotional health. So getting that some of that emotional release by physical movement and togetherness. So filling up some of his time he would be playing video games with those sorts of things is all for the good. As far as how often he actually spends with the videos and what kind of videos they are, I think those are both important. One is that kids, I have the book called It's Okay Not to Share, and we talk about that the child can keep playing with something as long as she wants to. That's the idea of we're not going to take something away from them. But when it comes to technology, different rules apply because research is showing and parents observe that kids have a very hard time self-limiting how long they play on a video game. The games are designed specifically to get us to want the next reward and get up to the next level, and they are working on all those positive feedbacks in our brain that want that reward. So it's very hard to stop. So you do need to set the limits, and some people have a certain amount of time a day. Some people have screens only on weekends. Some people say half an hour a day is tops. I mean, you have to set your own limits, and if he's used to a lot of hours, you might have to go gradually. Say, this week we're going to do this level, this week we're going to do that level. You have to physically remove it. You have to let him know what's what and be in charge, and you also have to put some power into his hands. So, for example, explain to him why you're concerned that he's spending so much time on it. And one thing may be, I'm concerned that the game is stronger than you are and that you are not able to stop on your own. This is not just you. This is how the games are designed. You need to show to me that you are stronger than the video game by stopping at a certain time and have him set the timer himself. So he's not pitting the control issue from him, from the child, to you, but rather having it be a challenge that he's pitting his own strength against the computer and that he can demonstrate that he's stronger than the computer, that he has more power there.
That's very good advice. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And of course, you as you said, you need to have things for that youngster to do with this new free time that he has.
Right. And at first, since it's a transition, you do need to be aware of that and even acknowledge it. At 11, you say, this is going to be different from what you're used to, but this is what we're going to do. And then just put it out there and then get used to it together. But give it some thought, talk to some other people, just bounce ideas off and come up with a plan you're comfortable with and then stick with it and be strong. Because there could be some pretty angry feelings coming. There's going to be a lot of grief coming from a situation where he's just had to move into a different house. So there's a lot of feelings, and be prepared that any of the negative feelings are okay, but not necessarily all the behavior that comes with it. So that's the key, whether we're talking about an angry 11-year-old or an angry toddler, is that the feeling of being angry is acceptable, is fine. You can be mad, you can be bad at me, but I can't let you hit me. I can't let you hurt the, you know, the table. I can't let you throw the lamp. You can be mad, but you can't hurt people or property.
Yeah, that was interesting. Peter, again, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Other callers as well, and John in West Allis wondered about his grandson, how to get his grandson not to be a picky eater. That's something I'm sure that we'll be able to talk about. We've got some other questions coming up about summer activities for children, things that children should be or could be doing on a as this summer season rolls around. Right now we've got coming up spring break for most school, for most students, and wondering, I know some parents who are wondering, what are my kids going to do the week of spring break? Heather Shoemaker, our guest today, she is the author of It's Okay Not to Share and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're talking today about raising your children, or maybe your grandchildren, or maybe your nieces or nephews. We've had some questions in that area as well with our guest, Heather Shoemaker. She is the author of It's Okay Not to Share, and It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Join in with your own experiences or questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And let's go to David in Appleton, who's been waiting a little bit here. David, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, there was a very good article in Sunday's New York Times on the rise in England of playgrounds that are more risky. In other words, kids are being so sheltered with playgrounds and other play things and not being able to walk to school. So they've started to institute some playgrounds that allow kids to get hurt, if you will. As they put it, have an ollie. They've got 2x4s and bricks and real boulders. And they don't have cushioned mats under the playground equipment. And they've got high slides and high swings and climbing things that I think a lot of us have when we were kids, and you learn if you get hurt once, you won't do the same thing again. And it also alluded to the problem in America is that we're such a litigious society that don't know if we'll see that again in the near future in the U.S.
Yeah, interesting comments. Heather?
Yes, well, I love that. He's talking about adventure playgrounds, as they're called, and I have a chapter in my book called Safety Second. It's about risk and why we sort of have a mentality in our culture about safety first, when actually if safety were the entire objective of life, we would be not doing anything and be bored. So safety is important, but it's not always the most important. Safety can come second, and we can learn a lot more and our kids can gain a lot more when we keep respecting safety but don't make it all powerful.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate it. John in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon. Great topic. So my wife and I run a wilderness guide service up in northern Wisconsin, and we really focus on kids and families and giving kids this kind of wilderness experience. And I just want, and what I've noticed is when you go places where there is no cell service, so there is no electronic devices allowed, I don't think there's a better way than just getting kids into nature and having them really explore things that they never would really notice, I guess, on a normal, typical day. And I just wanted to get your guest thoughts on utilizing nature and real, true nature experiences to kind of as a teaching tool.
Sure. Thank you, John. Heather?
Well, I'm actually a graduate of University of Wisconsin's Madison's Nelson Institute of Environmental Studies. So I'm my thoughts are very much aligned with the work that you're doing in northern Wisconsin there. Being out in nature, of course, gives so many benefits. picking up on the last caller, he was talking about risk. If you're giving your kids a chance to have more risks, you get a lot of dark eyes looking at you in the playground. You know, if you let them balance on something or stand on the swing or do something different that gives them more risk. But when you're out in the woods and they're balancing on logs or doing things out, there's fewer judging eyes, so you can relax, and nature gives a wonderful opportunity to explore risks as well as to explore nature itself. But most of the risks are the risk of getting dirty, getting wet. If you try to jump a stream and you don't quite make it all the way, the risk is getting your shoe wet. So these sorts of things are healthy and liberating, because you don't have as many people watching what you're doing, and nature just begs you to say, oh, can I balance on that log? Or how long can I hang off that tree branch? It's also important that kids are taking some of these risks in nature on their own terms. So, you know, encourage the child to climb a tree, but don't necessarily help them down. Put that responsibility for their own physical safety somewhat in their own hands. You can stand by the tree and say, where would be a good place to put your foot? So I think a lot of times kids feel so protected by us that they forget that they're really the ones responsible for their body. So teaching them to think, where could I put my foot? And that gives them, it helps give them that responsibility and knowledge of what their body can and can't do, what its limits are. But of course, nature on its own has so many wonderful qualities. As far as kids, their mental health is greatly enhanced by being outside, and so is adults. And their play, they don't have all kinds of plastic objects or video games presented to them when they're outside. So any idea that they have, they can play it out, and a stick can be most anything. You know, the kind of imaginative play that comes out outdoors is also liberating. And, of course, the environmental ethic of coming to love being outdoors. If we don't get kids outside all through their young life, they're not going to grow up caring about it as adults. So we need to get them out for so many reasons.
Yeah. Good points. Thank you so much for that call. I want to go back to John in West Allis, who wonders about his grandson. Is a very picky eater. He's four, and he only wants to eat hot dogs, not even the bun, just the hot dog.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. I can answer this, but on my two books, I specifically did not focus on things like picky eating, because some of these things like that there's not as much controversy about it. There's different approaches to how you would do it, but they're not such renegade ideas, so I tried to focus on the ideas where my philosophy differs from the rest of the country. So most people are pretty feel that with picky eating, there are some kids who are extremely picky eaters, and most kids are picky eaters to a degree. Continually introducing foods multiple times, the more they see it, the more they get used to it. And then a big thing is trust and waiting for their bodies to develop, because, and I'm speaking as a former picky eater, and I married my husband, it was even a pickier eater as a child. Now we both eat anything. Trust that at some point they will be a more adventuresome eater. It's a lot about the emotions in those young ages, and to decide that you're not going to make it a battle every night. There needs to be, you know, some variety for nutrition's sake, but decide how much you're going to push it, because having a battle every night over meals is really detrimental to both sides.
Yeah. Jay emailed to say his first grader is getting homework this year. Is this normal and necessary?
Oh, boy. Yes.
That opens up. I know your thoughts on this.
Well, the original title of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide was going to be It's Okay to Ban Elementary School Homework. So, and I do have about a quarter of the book is focused on homework and what you can do about it. Answering the question, unfortunately, it has become a new normal, but it is not healthy for kids. And there's things, if you're concerned about this, it's okay to go up the slide, is the book and resource, because it gets into some of the research about homework and exactly what you can do and how you can approach teachers and principals and to try to resolve this. But kids are getting homework as young as kindergarten and preschool. Sometimes those ages, they're even getting them in five subjects. And there's research that shows that homework has very, very little use in the younger years. They've done meta-analysis of homework studies, because a lot of people have studied homework. So they've done research studies about the research studies and come up with zero statistical difference between kids who were asked to do homework and kids who weren't asked to do homework in elementary school. There's no academic benefit in elementary school. But they have discovered, and I think many parents see this at the kitchen table every night, they have discovered that there is a negative impact of homework in the elementary school years, and that is tears and upset and turning against school and turning against learning. So, and it also steals sleep. A lot of kids are getting less and less sleep because they're getting more and more homework, which hurts memory and problem solving and learning.
Kind of going along with that, I really liked your take on recess as well, and not using recess as a punishment for young people.
Not taking it away as a punishment.
Yes.
Yeah, I've never heard of giving recess as a punishment.
No.
they found that in fact schools that have added recess get better academic results, which makes sense. The kids are able to pay attention more, and biologically, after moving, their bodies are able to learn more and retain information better. Recess, homework is coming into young children's lives in greater amounts than ever before, and recess is going away at the same time, so it's a double whammy. We're getting kids into the grind at a very early age, and that turns them against the real purpose of school and the joy of learning. Many schools have no recess at all, even for kids as young as kindergarten. And some schools, they start taking it away at older grades. Recess, really, kids need it at least through eighth grade. And they need it big chunks of time. They need it multiple times a day, so they need daily recess. They need it scattered through the day, not just lunch recess, which is very convenient for the adults who schedule the day, but to have a break in the morning, have a break at lunchtime, have a break in the afternoon, that's all important. And that gym class is not a substitute for recess. Gym is a structured time when the teacher tells you what to do, and kids need that break to be themselves, to get their feelings out, to move their bodies, to be with the friends they want to be with, and to learn to deal with social conflicts that happen on the recess playground. So that's all hugely important learning, and we need to be getting back to being recess heroes and sticking up for recess for our kids.
One of the areas you look at in your books is creativity. How do you encourage creativity in young children?
Well, a big way is to accept the ideas they come up with and not try to change them, and then stop scheduling every minute of their day. Because creativity is in the child, but we often program it out. So for technology, for example, I discuss the beauty of wandering minds. You know, don't worry if your child says she's bored. If a child of mine comes to me and says, I'm bored, I said, sounds like you don't know what to do right now. I know you will find something. And trust that they will, even if they kick up a fuss for a few minutes, because it's that downtime and the way the brain wanders when it has freedom to wander, no one's telling you what to do, that's where creativity comes. You get the ideas in the shower, you get the ideas when you're walking your dog. Creativity comes to us when we're not trying to do something. That's where I get a lot of ideas. I also write fiction. I get my ideas for writing books when I'm walking or when I'm gardening or when I'm washing the dishes, when I'm doing something that I'm not purposely trying to think. And kids need that too. I think we were talking about risk earlier and adventure playgrounds, but that was focusing more on physical risk. But there's also creative risk. So if your four-year-old boy dresses up in a tutu or your and does some sort of risk in their play that way, or comes up with using something, using a toy that you weren't thinking of that it would be used that way. That's all creative risk, and creativity comes from many sources. As long as we accept the child's play idea, as long as it's not hurting anything, and giving them time to do it.
And you sometimes, though, argue against crafts as a with kids as a creative tool.
Well, it depends. Yeah, I have chapters on art and projects like that. Many parents got quite mad at me for suggesting that crafts might not be the best thing. It happens the most in a classroom situation. If you're doing a craft with your child at home, there's usually a lot more flexibility, because if the child wants to, you know, put three eyeballs on the lion instead of two, you know, what's wrong with that? But in a classroom, if you walk down the hallways, you usually see 24 pumpkin pictures, and they all have triangles for noses, and they all have the circles for the eyes. So showing models, if you're trying to get creativity with kids, showing them a model of an adult craft project and saying this is what it's supposed to look like, then they're going to come up against failure because their little fingers don't glue quite as well as ours do, or their scissor work doesn't look quite like ours. And maybe they don't want to make a pumpkin. You know, maybe they're thinking about monsters, or maybe they're thinking about something completely different. So crafts don't necessarily, they're not evil. But be careful how you're presenting them. And are you allowing a child to work with the materials in a way that expresses her own ideas, or do they have to stick with a prepackaged program, which then makes a craft very similar to a video game?
Yeah. I was thinking about, I watched on public television a special with Jerry Apps, who was talking about his days growing up in a rural school, and Wisconsin Public Radio had a radio program for schools on art and how to draw. It's called Let's Draw. And Jerry described how the person, you know, how do you teach art on the air? The instructor would say, okay, put your heads down now and think about, and this was the example he used, you're going to Switzerland, or you're going here or there, and you're meeting this favorite composer, and think about the trip over, and think about walking into his studio and seeing his work and hearing him play the piano. Now draw, and then, you know, it was better than what I've just said, but he would then say, well, now draw that music. And I thought, what? What? And that was a wonderful way, I thought, for people to learn. And so everybody then, each child would, in his schoolroom all across Wisconsin, would draw what they imagined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the key is the imagination there.
Yeah.
He wasn't presenting this is what it should look like. He was presenting ideas and emotions and letting what was inside the child come out. And that's what creativity is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. There's a lot of worry, and one of the things that hasn't come up today, which almost surprises me, is bullying. It could be cyberbullying. It could be bullying, out in the schoolyard. What about that and dealing with that?
Well, that gets to the heart of both my books, but particularly It's Okay Not to Share, which it has a big section on conflict mediation and how you deal with conflicts. At the young ages, too, the word bully, the bully probably has just as many legitimate feelings as the other child. So at a certain age, they can fall into habits of being a legitimate bully. But when they're young, there's one kid who feels wronged and there's another kid who did something, but they both have legitimate feelings and neither kid is bad. So let's figure out what's going on and look at the conflict and teach the kids to speak up and say stop. Even when they're 2 years old, teaching those skills of if you don't like something, set limits. Set limits directly on a peer, and the adults can be there to help, but having them realize something is happening I don't like, and I don't have to take it. I can stand up and do something about it, and helping those with bullying. Usually, there's a lot of bystanders, so helping bystanders realize to watch somebody's face. Oh, you as an adult can point out. Joe's face just changed. It looks like he doesn't like being splashed, or he didn't like it when you pushed him. Did you like being pushed? And if you're talking with young kids, of course, sometimes they'll say, yeah, that was fun, because physical friendships are often born by a little back-and-forth puppy play. So be sure you ask, did you like it when he, did you like it when she did whatever it is? But help them verbalize that they didn't like an action, and then tell the other person directly, and then sort it out and sort out those feelings. So, yes, bullying is one aspect of repeatedly targeting a certain person, but a lot of what goes into that is basic conflict mediation and learning to speak up, stand up for yourself, and set limits.
What are we doing that's right with our kids these days? And if there was one thing that you wish we would be more mindful of when it comes to raising our children, what would that be? So that's a kind of a two-part question.
Yeah, well, parents and grandparents and caregivers, we all love our kids just as much as we ever have. I think we're feeling a lot more stress as a culture, and there's a lot of new things coming at us, whether it's technology or other things like that. So we get a bit uncertain. And I think in that uncertainty, we just need to remember to trust kids more, trust their ideas, trust their play, set limits when we need to, such as you can't hurt people, but you can have that big feeling. And remember that there's no rush, and we don't need to have them become adults too fast. So they don't need to be doing all that homework and things when they're very young, but trust them.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun, Heather. You get out and speak a lot these days?
Yeah, I do. I speak around the country, speak to parents and teachers and at conferences, and a lot of people know that the things I'm saying, they've already felt in their gut. They just haven't heard anybody say them before.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you stop by and talk with us, Heather, and I hope we have a chance to do this again. Do you have another book coming out?
Well, my next book is a children's fiction book, The Griffins of Castle Cary, coming out next March.
Maybe we'll have you back and talk about that. Thank you, Heather.
Yeah, it's a ghost story.
Oh, okay. Heather.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. Heather Shoemaker is the author of It's Okay Not to Share. Her other book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. That was really interesting and fun for me. Hope it was for you, too. Melinda Myers joins us tomorrow for Garden Talk. In the meantime, stay with us.